He has the coveted job description of the stud man in our older event. He's got a jacket that the girls gave him as a joke as well, but he has quite the extensive kit with special tools, and he's the guy that comes in and takes care of putting in all the studs for cross country and show jumping if needed.
Wow. I think that every guy wants to be referred to as the stud man in the family, right? And have a special moniker and jacket. That's, wow. Lucky guy.
Well, know what you're getting for Christmas. Welcome to the Major League Eventing Podcast, the show for eventing fans by eventing fans. Hey, Rob, like always, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Exhibitors.
Oh, we love Exhibitors.
Yeah, absolutely. Great stuff. Great stuff. This week, we'd like to feature their Quick Braid. Quick Braid is your go-to finishing product for all types of styling or training for your horse's mane and tail. You can train stand-up manes and tail to lie flat. Best of all, Quick Braid combs right out without washing, allowing easier mane and tail care for days after any event. The formula is designed especially for show ring results and is superior to using water or human styling product alternatives. They recommend using quick shampoo and quick conditioner prior to styling with Quick Braid.
Yeah, that's some awesome stuff. Well, you know, I'm a terrible braider, Karen, so that's why I'm not allowed to touch the stuff.
But right.
Even this will help me out. So.
But I've used it. It's great stuff.
Awesome, awesome. So thank you very much, Exhibitors. We sure do appreciate it. It's pretty much everywhere, right, Karen?
Yep. And like they say, groom like you mean it.
Triple Crown Feed,
oh,
Karen.
Yeah.
Triple Crown, big fans of Triple Crown Feed. They have tons of great products out there,
mm-hmm.
Premium stuff. Karen, what do you got to say over there?
So Triple Crown has formulas that are tailored to your horse's unique needs and help support immunity and gut health. Find your local Triple Crown Feed dealer by going to triplecrownfeed.com.
Triplecrownfeed.com. That's a little bit of a tongue twister.
It is.
Triplecrownfeed.com. They have a great feed locator. They have a great feed comparison tool on their website. I encourage everyone to get over there. Check out Triple Crown Feed's website. Check out the different products. Check out what makes them so special. And give them a shot, right, Karen?
Oh, yeah.
Support the people that support the show.
And we'd like to welcome our newest sponsor, Patricia Scott Insurance. Now, Trish is very passionate about helping those who share her love of horses. With over 30 years of experience in writing equine insurance, and she's also an FEI licensed to eventing steward, she understands the unique risks and liabilities faced by horse farm and ranch owners. And she's able to tailor your policy to meet your specific needs. Don't risk your passion. Get insured today. Now, Trish is always only a phone call away, so you can call her at 484-319-8923.
I'm Rob.
And I'm Karen. And Rob's super excited about today's guest.
I'm so excited, Karen.
We're big fans. So we have Olympian Becky Holder.
Becky, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I am such an Olympic geek, Karen.
I know.
That, you know, when I see Olympians, I get all... I'm a
get
big
excited.
Kid. I am get excited. I do. I'm a fanboy out a little
bit.
The
Olympics are definitely something to be excited about.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I'm so excited, Karen. Becky, thank you so much for joining us. You know, we watched you for so many years. You know, I think Karen got me introduced to eventing, and I mm-hmm. think then you learned more about eventing. But you know, and you were at the top of the sport. You know, when I was learning about eventing and everything, so it was, you know, there was. Everything we ever saw, you were there. It was always at the end of the competition. You know, you're always on top of the leaderboard. So it was just
and on one of my favorite horses of all time.
Who's that?
Courageous Comet.
Of course, I knew that answer. But
mine too, by the way.
I used to get excited when I'd see the two of you together. It was so fun to watch.
We have a lot of DVDs.
Out in a sand pit right now as we speak. Just having a sun bath.
We have lots of VHSs and DVDs with Becky in them.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. I know.
I know. We're moving right now, and we've come across so many Burley discs and Rolex in names that where there are kids that weren't even born yet. And yeah, I go through all those different, exactly, VHS and VCR and all that action.
Yeah.
Funny to run across that stuff.
Yeah, it is. So and then you're like, man, this was the good old days.
Yeah.
You're popping in the tape. So,
Becky, you just mentioned that you're moving. Can you tell us where you're coming to us from?
I am at our farm in Wadesboro, North Carolina, which is about an hour and a half west of the Carolina Horse Park. Wadesboro / AKA the borough, as we like to refer to it as. Little town. We're kind of surrounded by chicken houses and a beautiful farm that has rolling acres of sandy, loamy black dirt. And it's fantastic footing. Great place to train from. And it is the home that we plan to retire on and be here for, well, forever.
That's awesome. Yeah. So where you're at now is the where you're moving to home?
I have been here now for a couple of years. My husband's been commuting back and forth. We had a small farm in Palmetto, Georgia, which is about 8 miles away from Chat Hills, the Chat Hills vending site. And hopefully everything goes through, but it's now being bought by one of my previous working students and students, Sarah Dunkerton Sizemore, who is Rick Dunkerton of Vent Entries, his daughter, and she's recently married. And they are purchasing the farm from me, and she's doing business there with eventing and lessons and ship-ins and training and all of that. So it's really exciting to see it go to someone who's going to use it for what it was intended for.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That is really, really cool.
Yeah, it is.
We were talking a little bit before we actually started recording, and you said like your husband has a really, he's a, I guess was a pilot and it was a U-2 pilot. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. He was a U-2 pilot. He came from the C-130 ranks and was a U-2 pilot, but he, previous to being a U-2 pilot, he also flew into hurricanes on C-130s.
Wow.
So he's always been very, very understanding of my intense, focused job that I do in my sport, and always been the big enabler in my life and always helped me. I mean, he's been there since I met him right before Sydney 2000. So he's been in my life for most of my career.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Over Becky's, we're watching a video. Over Becky's left shoulder is a picture of her on, I'm guessing, Courageous Comet. And over the right is a jet. Is a jet. Over the right shoulder is a fighter jet. So
that must have been just a random jet. It's not even his U-2, but yep, sure enough. It is.
Well, fun fact, when I was in the Marines, I was in the aviation side also. Mm-hmm. I wasn't a pilot, but I was in the aviation side. And we would go to Air Force bases and the U-2 plane. If anyone's in airplanes, the U-2 is a really cool spy plane, essentially. And so I think that's really cool that your husband, they fly like in the stratosphere. It's really cool stuff. I'll get off of the whole thing. I get geeky, but let him know that I'm a big fan of anyone that can fly the U-2s and the C-130 storm chasers are really cool too. So.
Yeah.
Hopefully I get to meet him someday and pick his brain a little bit because I find that very
interesting. He's always with me. He has the coveted job description of the stud man in our other event. He's got a jacket that the girls gave him as a joke as well, but he has quite the extensive kit with special tools and he's the guy that comes in and takes care of putting in all the studs for cross country and show jumping if needed.
Wow. I think that every guy wants to be referred to as the stud man in the family, right? And have a special moniker and jacket. That's, wow. Lucky guy.
Know what you're getting for Christmas.
Got the Christmas list all set now. Father's Day.
Right. Oh, gosh. So, Becky, can you take us back and tell us how you actually got your start in riding and then into eventing?
So I always was a horse crazy little kid. My father was in the military, and we moved around a lot in the early days, even a stint in Alaska. So the best I had in the beginning was Barbie dolls and Briar horses. And my Barbie dolls, much like every other horse crazy kid, all had broken hips because they just don't work that way. You know, it is on top. And the Briar horses, actually, they were jumping the Barbie house and the Barbie car way before I ever got to ride my very own first horse. And we moved to Fort Leavenworth. My father was stationed in Fort Leavenworth. And I saw a sign up on the board for 14 horseback riding lessons, like beginner lessons. And somehow talked my parents into letting me sign up for these 14 lessons. I never turned back. I took those first 14 lessons and kind of found my thing. I thought I found my thing. Probably everyone around me thought I was just an annoying child that thought she was a horse whisperer. I knew all the books and read all the books. But I had a wonderful lady in my life at that time who ran the stable where I took the lessons, named Verna Malkut in Leavenworth, Kansas. And she did jumpers, but she also ran a very busy lesson program. And I ended up doing a little bit of what you call now working student, but basically she let me hang around because I can't imagine I was really that helpful at all in the early days. But we got to ride the leftover lesson horses at the end of the day. We got to go to horse shows with her. And that was sort of how I broke into it in the beginning. Unfortunately, about a year or two into my relationship at that barn, the barn went under and they had to sell the lesson horses. And a wonderful family came to me and talked my parents and talked me into half owning a little Appaloosa named Rocky. War Rocket Boy was his registered name. It was a lovely little Appaloosa. And he was supposed to be this father's chance to ride with his daughter out on trails when she came out on weekends and just once a week. And all I had to do was take care of this horse. And I had him basically for my own the rest of the time, you know, and at that time it's a hefty purchase of, you know, he might've been half of him might've been $350, you know, at that time.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we were at the Fort Stables at Fort Leavenworth, which are old cavalry stables. And they're awesome, beautiful. If you're ever driving through that area, you should go in there and peek your head in because they're all cobblestone aisles and lots of stone and brick and lots of history there at Fort Leavenworth, especially with the horses. But I also got introduced to Pony Club during that period of time. And I had a really bad habit of going through the Pony Club manual, and I was 12. So girls don't share their horses very much. You know, that's hard for them to do. And pretty much on the mark, every time the poor man would try to come out and ride this horse for his one day a week, he would have, you name it, there's a long, long, many chapters of ailments that can happen to horses in the Pony Club manual. Yeah. And unfortunately, this came to an end about 6 months after we had gotten involved with this co-ownership deal. And the man came to my parents and said, this isn't working. You know, you're going to have to purchase the other half or we're going to have to sell the horse. Well, my father was so upset with me, and it took a long time for him to forgive me for us having to buy the other half of that horse. But eventually the fox hunt people drew him in, and he ended up whipping in and fox hunting along with me for a number of years, you know, and it became his passion as well. So he figured if you can't beat him, you better join him.
Right.
That was kind of how it began, with a classic fox hunting and pony club kind of background at Fort Leavenworth. And without those people, without that family early on of the whole hunt and the Pony Club, I wouldn't be where I am today, because I would not have been able to be at an affluent stable and never would have been given all the opportunities that, I was given. So I'm really full of appreciation for all those people.
Wow. Mm. Very cool.
Yeah.
So now, as you got older, like when you, how did you start getting serious about eventing?
Well, I didn't even know about eventing until the early parts of Pony Club. I was sort of a hellion, and I was always getting in trouble for doing stupid things like jumping out of the arena and, you know, anything I could think of. I was always sort of trying to figure out what I could talk the horse into doing for me. And I actually had one of the officer's wives pull me aside and threaten that I was going to get kicked out of the barn. Ooh. And I hid from her for a good 3 days. It was a self-care stable. And then she came back and she gave me the paperwork for an organization that she said encouraged this kind of behavior. And it was the United States Combined Training Association.
Encouraged this behavior.
So from there, I signed up and learned more and rose through the ranks in the Pony Club and received my first omnibus and then began to plan my life around the omnibus, you know, and those paper omnibuses ran my life like a life calendar for many, many years. So, you know, I will still pay to have that arrive in my mailbox. Yeah. Always.
That's funny. That's funny. Yeah. So now did you, as a teenager, like, did you end up working for somebody, like as a legit working student, or how did you learn the ropes of eventing? Was it all just through
Pony Club? Through Pony Club, through being a rail bird, there was probably 75 horses at the Fort Leavenworth stables and they came and went. We had a few like amazing clinicians that came into our area. Ralph Hill was kind of in and out of Area 4 a lot. I had a local wonderful lady named Donna Lewis that helped me tremendously. Back in the day in Missouri and Kansas, they had Blythe Tate come in. And what's funny about all those people is they were well over my head at the time, you know, and if I couldn't afford to ride in the clinic, I went and audited and watched and got really good. And I mean, to this day, I really believe you can get almost as much out of going and watching people and thinking how it might feel if you were them as I do actually riding with someone. So I think that was a huge part of my formative career was in those early days. My first formal education came with clinics with Jim Graham. I had ridden with Dorothy Trapp at that time, Dorothy Crowell now. And, you know, it kind of pieced together. I wasn't a regular. And at that point, I didn't even know I was in Area 4, such a big area. I mean, kids today are so connected by social media and that's good and bad. But in those days, they had a pretty good young rider program, but I knew nothing about it. I was running prelim and intermediate on homebred half draft horses in the area and, you know, never got a tap on the shoulder that was like, hey, you know, you're 16 and doing intermediate. There's something out there for you, you know, and it's just kind of the way that it was at that time, you know, and Chicago was a big rumbling area. And a lot of people that were in Chicago area were in the know, but I was clearly kind of off to the side and didn't really get it. So it took me a while to kind of put those pieces together, but I was just having a blast. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd see something that was in the omnibus or an event, and I was determined to go there, and there's another level, and I'm going to go to that level. But I didn't have a really good idea of the big picture till much later.
Wow. Well, somehow you put the pay. What was the light bulb moment? You know, what
was exactly. I mean, I had this wonderful horse early on that I worked for, a wonderful couple named Ralph and Diane Hicks, who were fox hunt people, but they were also running a breeding program. and they were mixing Tricaners with thoroughbreds and a little bit of Percheron in there. Okay. And similar to like what you would say a Canadian bread might have a similar mix of that kind of thing, or even an Irish bread. You know, they didn't necessarily want the half perch, but a little bit in there, because what they wanted was something you could show, but also fox hunt, and just a nice horse that was durable, that was going to be around for a while. And I got a lot of showing opportunities from them. And then sort of my breakout horse was a young horse called Knudsen, who I braided when he was 2 months old at a breed show. And then later he came in for training to be broke. And a couple of people came to look at him to buy. And I was just devastated. And after one of them left and I waited a couple of days, I called up Ralph Nine and said, I don't know what it's going to take, you know, how many money, don't know what we're doing. But I got to have this horse. And they were like, yeah, that's okay. Decide how much you can pay once a month. And you know, we'll make it happen. And so I basically broke horses for them and worked for them and house sat and farm sat for them. But they gave me a breakout opportunity. And that horse went and competed all over the United States, all up through the levels. And at that time, we didn't have the depth of advanced competitions in the country, but we had a number of them. And he went and was always top 10 at all of those. And I would take lessons from whoever I could, take clinics. I was still living in Kansas. And I got into a groove with Jim Graham and doing clinics. And he was getting ready at that time to go over to England to train. And he started to say, you know, you're starting to get, you know, that's what you need to do is go. And everybody at that point, Dorothy was in England, and Karen and David were in England. And, you know, and so there's this whole world out there. I went and did the advanced horse trials at Rolex. I can't even remember what year I went as the first year, but I kind of sort of stuck my toe in most of the advanced competitions here in the States. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's what I need to do. So wonderful. Again, the Midwest came through for me. I had just, it seemed like doors opened when they needed to be open. And I had amazing group of people that helped sell t-shirts and throw parties and like the literal bake sale and the rest of it. And through the American Horse Trials Foundation, we were able to raise a chunk of change for me to go to England to train in 1995 for 3 months.
Wow.
So I put the horse on the plane. I packed up my little suitcases and off I went. And I was a nobody. I wasn't on a training list. I was just like all about this big adventure, and I wanted to go learn, and I was going to be close to and near. I set up two lessons with Mark Todd while I was over there in England, and took my big old horse. I got to compete at the Gatcom Open Championships there at Princess Anne's Gatcom, the whole nine yards. And I had decent showings. I went to Thurlston and did the Scottish Open Championships with that horse. And I was aimed for Bocolo, which I had two pretty decent phases until fence 21. And then I had a long walk home, of course, that I didn't get around. But I was still so much better for just reaching than I ever had. And then after that, things got pretty serious. And people along the way have helped me so much. I have so many. You know, my first horse that I went to the Sydney Olympics on, Highland Hogan, was owned by a wonderful lady named Faye Wolf, who is a big supporter of mine for many, many years. And she had bought Hogan off of the track because he looked like he had sweet eyes. You know, and so when I met him, he was going beginner novice, or he wasn't going. We were going to go after much wrestling. He and I came to an agreement, and I started him at beginner novice, and he had a water problem in the early days. And I still have Diddy. It would have come across these same tapes that you were talking about, and of him going through his first water jump, and everybody cheering at beginner novice because he went through his first little puddle. But that horse went on, and he was truly a breakout horse. And then I threw David and Karen. They were my first consistent training that I had. They invited me out to Middleburg to train before the Sydney Olympics. I made my first training list that year. And then I got to go somehow, ended up 21 people went into quarantine at Foxhall before the Sydney Olympics. 12 of us got on an airplane. Then the numbers, like Survivor Island, just kept diminishing as you got closer, as you got closer and closer to the Sydney Olympics. And then 7 of us went, and it was, you know, amazing. At that time, there was still the team and the individual as separate courses and separate dressage tests. And I ended up going as the alternate. And I'll never forget the day that I found out or knew or realized, because I was just swept up in the whole thing. I might as well have been like Dorothy and Toto, because the whole thing that was happening was so amazing. And I was so caught up in it. And I got to train for 3 months with Captain Phillips. And that was the most regular training I'd ever had my entire life.
Wow.
Formalized kind of training. The rest of it was, you know, on the job, fox hunting and running hill and dale. And I was asked to run some passports of all these horses to an office or wherever it was, to a vet. I can't even remember. And, you know, you're sitting there with Gilt Edge, Prince Panache, custom made, and are you going to not flip through their passport? Well, of course you are. So I remember flipping pages, you know, and I'm looking at pages, and my gosh, there's stamps. There's like pages and pages of stamps. And I remember looking at all of those, and then I flipped to mine, and it's got Mid-South, Camino Real, which was a 2-star, you know, at that time, Fair Hill, and Rolex. Wow. That was it. I was like, that's the standard. So it's like, okay, you know, you're the reserve. You're gonna and that's okay.
Wow.
You know, so that was an amazing, amazing trip, amazing adventure. Probably the best thing that I ever remember about that trip was that Julie Richards and I got to go to the opening ceremonies. And very often the equestrian starts at a time where you can't attend the opening ceremonies. And Sydney's was giant and amazing. And they queue you up in a gymnasium way ahead of time by country. And I remember sitting in that gymnasium, and the Kiwis and the Australians, of course, had quite the battle going. And they were there in the gymnasium going, oi, 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 Aussie, 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 and screaming like a pep rally, like the most giant pep rally. Then they march you in the dark in giant by country, and you're just mashed together and being pushed against each other. And they tell you there's someone standing there. And they say, when you hit the field, don't stop. And you're like, yeah, yeah, you're just having a good time. And Julie got us up near the female basketball players for the U.S., which were just rowdy as heck and so full of spirit and all of that. And so we were really, really wound up, and we got down closer to the field. When you hit the field, don't stop. When you hit the field, don't stop. And of course, you go down from the dark where you're kind of like waiting for a rock concert in the dark back lane. And you go down onto the AstroTurf and you hit the turf, and the lights are shining and the country colors are going and the stands are full. And what do? You stop. Stop. And then you get slammed into from behind, you know, and it's like, okay, that's why they told us that. But, life memory that amazing. I mean, I didn't get to compete. I got to jog 2 times, once for the team and once for the individual. And I knew both tests. I knew both sets of markers. I walked both courses, and they didn't need me. So then I went to a kangaroo park with my husband. But still, you know, one of my very favorite trips of all time.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
But you did ultimately get to compete in the Olympics.
I did, yes. You know, that coat, that red coat, went into my closet in 2000 and didn't come out again until 2008.
Wow. You were, they didn't give you a fresh coat for 2008?
Yeah, that particular one had a purpose for me. By God, I was going to wear that coat. So, you know, that's it. But that thing hung in my closet as a, you know, you will be here again. But it did. It took 8 years. It take your 8 years to find my way back. But, you know, and lots of amazing things in the meantime. But it really is amazing what a milestone that piece of it is. And then actually getting to wear it, because I didn't get to wear it at that Olympic Games. Right. So I had it. It was ready. It was all queued up. You know, had the prom dress and didn't go to prom, you know. So for a long time, it hung in my closet. So it was a really, really big deal to be able to break that out.
That's awesome.
And go.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I love it. How was that? What was that experience like? Could you shed some light on that one?
The Hong Kong experience was also just each team trip that goes away to a different country has its own amazing adventures. You know, when you're going, that one, we went to England ahead of time and stayed at Barbary and got all queued up and ready to go there. And the racetrack at Hong Kong, they really rolled out the red carpet. We had air conditioned vans. I'm assuming that a lot of things will be similar for Tokyo because of the heat, you know, when they're going. The racetrack, the stalls, everything, the barns were air conditioned. They had amazing arenas set up inside of the actual racetrack proper. And then on the racetrack, they had different sections for conditioning that you could go out and condition. I remember we went out to do a final breeze, and Comet, in all the years I've had him, has never really lost it. And he had some wacky flashback. And when I set off to have just a light breeze up this gallop lane, I mean, I thought I was going to lose a knuckle trying to keep him under wraps. Oh, he totally had a flashback.
He forgot he was an off-the-track thoroughbred, huh?
I think I've galloped fast, but I don't think I have any idea how fast those horses can really get going.
Wow.
So, you know, that that was one of the big memories there. And showing under the lights in the stadium, because I got picked to do the dressage at night. So it's very dramatic, you know, and you're out in the warm-up area and everything's very well lit, of course, but still it's got a different feel when you're going dressage at 8:40 or 9:40 at night, you know, when you're trying to get away from the heat, you know, it's a little different feeling. My husband probably would tell you that his favorite memory was in the stabling area. They had this really cool stall called the rolling stall. There's a whole separate stall full of sand. And you take the horses in there and turn loose and let them roll because, of course, they weren't getting turnout or anything. And Comet got to go do that once or twice. But my husband thought that was pretty cool. And years later, dug out an area in the orange clay in our farm in Georgia and brought in a big load of white sand so my gray horses had a rolling hole. And, you know, one of my sweet memories of him, that he remembered how much they liked that.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Man, oh man.
That was neat.
That's awesome, Karen.
Yeah.
Gosh. When the Olympics come up like this year with it being an Olympic year, do you pay close attention to it still?
I do. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the whole Olympic movement to kind of devote yourself at one point in your life to being excellent and to follow that, to understand the sacrifices and to understand the striving that level, the effect it has on you and really has on you for your entire life, is it's something that I will always cherish. And I absolute respect for anyone who has their sights set in that direction and who's kind of putting all of themselves into it, because there really is nothing else like it. And I really support our sport continuing and being a part of that, because I mean, I work with the grassroots level. I work with the whole picture, and I think having having that mountaintop, having that peak is super important for inspiration all through all the levels, through all people. It's a uniting force. We got to go visit it's all in the Olympics. Which one? I think it was Sydney. And we got to go to the competitors, to the athletes' village, and mix and mingle with the athletes. And it was before the opening ceremony. And when you're milling about, they have everybody come out in the street prior to being picked up, like on a bus stop. And, you know, you have the gymnasts. They perhaps have a certain look to them. And, you know, the basketball players perhaps have a certain look to them. The equestrian is a little different when you've got dressage people and then eventers, and we're all different shapes and sizes. But to have all of those athletes kind of striving, reaching, you know, having given up, having pushed, having and it all in one place at one time, there's magic in the air. And I will always in some way be a part of that, whether it's breeding horses that go there or teaching people that I hope go there and are a part of it. It's really embedded in my genes. I think I really always want to be a part of it.
Yeah. So cool. Mm-hmm. Very cool. Hey, and before we move on, comment. Off the track thoroughbred, can you tell us a little bit? Like, I mean, when you have a legendary horse, it'd be great to just kind of hear a little of the story about how you guys came to be.
He's amazing, of course. In 2001, in the fall of 2001, Beowulf and I, we decided we were going to go looking for a prospect, you know, something to kind of be next. And at that time, I was living out in Middleburg, kind of near David and Karen. And I was looking for something. And I'd gone and sat on a few. I'd even vetted one or two. And I rode up the hill. I had to hack to get to the O'Connor's ring. And I was hacking along, and I went through a gate and came up on their ring. And there was this gray horse about throwing his legs off the end of his cannon bones, trotting around the ring. Like his signature, his front end is just ridiculous when he trots and puffed up, and he was spooking and doing whatever. And one of David's students was sitting on him and trying him. And I was just sitting on the horse I was on outside the ring, and he could probably just feel my eyes boring into him. I don't know exactly. Well, she kept going for a little bit, trotting canter, and the horse was pretty green. He'd been sourced off the track and then connected that way. And David was finally like, just get off of him and let her get on, you know? And so I did. I got on him. I loved him. He was quirky as heck. He came out for the first 3 or 4 months of his life and stopped at every crossrail I ever pointed him at. He was ridiculous, not ever ditchy or scared of anything that way. Always funny about footing changes. And, you know, here's a horse, if you put hoof oil on him in the cross tie, and he still does this to this day, he thinks it's a snake on the ground when he steps away, and it leaves a little oil ring. Spent a whole winter part of sort of figuring out his show jumping. I spent an entire off season leading him over a pole on the ground, trying to get him to walk over a single pole, doing a line of trot poles or a placing rail. What took his most of his career to talk him into, you know, he was just allergic to the things. And, you know, I mean, they're so funny how quirky they can be. You know, he was not a tremendously personable horse in his stall. The girls who work for me would probably laugh at that because they nicknamed him Courageous Cobra for a while in the stall. But now he's just as sweet as he can absolutely be. You know, he kind of really grew on all of us. And in the early days, we took him to horse show in Florida, and he stall walked very badly. And he was spinning around. You could only see a dust cloud. I had to pull him out, hose him off. We put tack on him. And I'm like, well, And I don't know how this is going to go, but I guess I'll ride him out to the dressage warm-up. He's like novice or something, you know, and got on him, you know, and wrestled me up there on him. And he pranced out, and then, bam, was he all business. He strutted around that ring and showed me that presence that he had throughout his entire career. Loved a crowd, absolutely loved a crowd. Thrived on the bigger the crowd, the better. One of his worst dressages was one of the bad weather years at Jersey Fresh when they did it in the indoor and there was no real crowd, you know, and it was in that indoor arena. And he's like, well, why are we showing up for this? You know, he, the bigger, the better. Loved Kentucky. Absolutely loved Kentucky. Hands down. Loved that crowd. The people loved him there, you know, and always put his best performance forward at that venue. He's here. He's retired. He hangs out with his buddy. His little doppelganger can't fire me. His bar name is Teddy. And he's not being ridden much now. He's 25, but he's happy. He's fat. He, you know, he's very much part of the barn routine. He gets the 5-star care retirement and he gets brought in and groomed every day and has his share of treats and likes to keep track of everyone in the barn and has his turnout paddock and his special rolling hole. So, you know, it's been one of the big privileges of my life to be able to retire that horse and enjoy him in his retirement. Man. So that's really cool.
That's fantastic.
That is fantastic.
Such a great story.
Yeah, it is.
Oh my gosh. I love hearing about how quirky the horses are.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because I think a lot of people, you know, they see you go around Kentucky or the Olympics and they think, wow, you know, that's a made horse, you know, and people, you know, people forget horses are horses, you know, and they all have their quirks and you invest a lot of time in trying to work through all those quirks. That's funny. I love the hoof oil part. That's the funniest. Oh, that's fantastic. Well, so thankful. Still doing good. So that takes us to today. So what's today's, you know, business like? How do you keep your days busy? You said you had the big farm and what do you got going?
I do a lot of teaching. I have a lot of ship-in clients that come in from Southern Pines. I have lots of students who relocated to the area. One of my top assistants was Nobi Cannon, and she now runs a business in Southern Pines, North Carolina, and she ships back and forth for her lessons. I have another girl that works for Phil and Melissa Town. They are the ones that, in partnership with Tom, with my husband, bought Can't Fire Me, who was Teddy, and he's the one that was nearly Horse of the Year, got beaten by Buck and Reggie, fair enough.
Yeah.
And fair enough for the end of the year, for the Horse of the Year. But he's a great horse, and on his own merit would have been a star if he wasn't always overshadowed by Comet in the stable. I have a working student that now works for them named Sarah Beth Anton at Starting Point Farm, and she ships in with her horses, and all of those girls are super talented. I teach a program in Minnesota for young riders and 21 and under, and it's been a program that has been running for, this is the 20th year. It's been running 21 years, I think, actually, but I came into it a year after it got started. And I have had 20 kids for 10 clinic days a summer for 20 years. So these kids have grown up. They've gone to E18, they've gone to U25. They're some professionals out in the industry, but it's had a profound impact on my life. You know, a lot of them have come on here and stayed for winter working students. And I mean, it's wonderful, wonderful people up in Minnesota. And I also teach adult clinics up there. So I haven't had to really go looking for outside business for a very long time. From January to April, I bring people in for the winter, and I have people that have been coming to me since for 20 years, basically. And they come down and the horse goes in training, and maybe they have to go back and work and come back and go to horse shows, or the young riders come down and try to get qualified for young riders. and we do the same thing, and I sort of try to make everybody's dreams come true. Wow. And kind of work towards goals that way. And I've kind of thrown myself into it. I have a couple of lovely off-the-track thoroughbreds right now that I'm bringing along. And one just did his first training, and the other one just did his first beginner novice. And, you know, with any luck, we'll see them out in a year or two doing something big. But I'm really, really doing a ton of teaching, and I just love it. I've always loved it. It's something I've always done from day one. And I think, I hope I will go to my grave doing it as long as I can still talk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you still open? Do you have like open dates for clinics and stuff for people to fly you in?
You know, I really don't.
Wow.
We have to book them about 3 years in advance.
Wow.
And, wow. You know, and even then the weekends are sort of set. I promised my husband to give him at least one weekend every month. You know, he's the big enabler. You know, he's the guy in the back that's perfectly happy to go with me wherever I am in the world. And if it weren't for his flight privileges to Northwest Airlines, we probably wouldn't be together, because he likes to say that I let him chase me till I caught him. Is that what he says? Yeah, you know, something along those lines. You know, but yeah, so no, I'm pretty booked up.
How about that? Do you have room for people to come in? Like, do you still have openings for people to come and train with you at home?
Yes, we set in the off season. So basically when it starts getting hot down here, May through October, a lot of openings. We have run a smaller barn, and then we're pretty much full up starting kind of in October, November, December. And I maybe have two spots open for the winter, but wow. I'm pretty much set ahead of time.
Wow. Busy, busy.
Yeah.
Well, of course it's you know what I mean?
Well, and you know, everybody chooses a path, and I've always chosen to keep it smaller and more personal at the farm. So, you know, there's only so many hours in the day. Sure. And so by the time we're done with horses and lessons, you know, we're somewhere around the 22 mark. That's okay. About 22 in a day is what you can personally touch.
Yeah.
You know, and put hands on and teach yourself, you know, and that's sort of where I've kept it.
Yeah. And you mentioned the off the track thoroughbreds. Do you still think there's a spot like at the upper levels for off the track thoroughbreds with the modern sport?
I absolutely do. You know, I am a big thoroughbred fan. They've taken me, both my Olympic horses were off the track thoroughbreds. I've had other maybe five that reached the advanced level, they were all off the track thoroughbreds. Maybe it's just because that's what I've been able to source and work with, but you have to go looking a little harder, and you've got to do the work from the ground floor up. Like, I think the thoroughbred personality really craves a partnership. And so those people that are the ones that rode it a month off the track, you know, started in the beginning and built that partnership with it, those are probably the ones that are going to have that kind of success with it. Hmm. But, you know, I think that certainly a lot of thoroughbred blood is out there. And I have had Oldenburgs. Oh, I just bred. That's exciting too. I do have another exciting thing. I have Comet's half sister. So, you know how this is, it really a half sister if it's just the same sire? So a Comet Shine mare named Lipstick Jungle. I competed her up through intermediate, and I bred her to an Oldenburg named Fairbanks, who is sort of a big fancy steppy, and the three-year-old, he's coming three, he'll be three in like 2 weeks. He's here in the barn now. So the Comet nephew, you can maybe call him.
Yeah.
His name is Corey. Falcor is his name. So he's sort of a fun up and coming one. You know, I don't know if I'll be the one that competes him, but you know, we'll train him up, and I've got plenty of riders that I've trained, and maybe somebody will get the chance on him.
Wow. So how much breeding are you doing? You doing a lot of
breeding? Me personally, I tried my hand a little bit with one mare, and the disappointment nearly killed me. So I'll take my hat off to these breeders. I mean, I have this lovely intermediate mare from Bill and Ingville Ramberg up in Minnesota. And Ingville has a real touch for the breeding program. I think they're foaling out 9 to 10 foals this year. And the bloodlines on them are every bit as good as anything you would see coming out of one of the fancy Irish sales. There's some seriously well-bred European bloodlines and Irish bloodlines and amazing. So I get to ride those and train those. You know, they get to come to me as rank 3 and 4 year olds. But I take my hat off to the breeders in this country, because it is just a heartbreaking business. Mm-hmm. You know, that it so many unknowns. And I think I'm really more the next stage girl, the young horses that can come to me than the breeder.
Gotcha. Huh. Hey, well, it's we you know, I think that's important to know where your strengths lie, you know, and focus on them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Becky, we are going to play quick fire questions.
Quick fire questions.
You know the show. So this quick fire questions is brought to you by Red and Goat Equestrian. So 5 questions. And of course, you don't have to answer them quickly, but we do grade you at the end.
I don't feel right grading an Olympian, Karen. I just don't feel worthy. All right. That's the show.
That's the show.
You've been granted permission, so all right. All right.
So, favorite rider growing up?
I'd say have to be Bruce Davidson. I mean, I was in all that time with Eagle Lion and all of those, and I mean, just what an icon in our sport. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. That's a great answer.
Yeah. Next question. Do you have any good luck or superstitions before going out cross country?
I always have lucky socks, and they have to be the socks like, to each horse. Comet, of course, had unicorn socks cross country. And I have one of my thoroughbreds is he's very uphill built. Very alert, and I have llama socks for him. So he has lucky llama socks. And I'm not ready to give up my medical armband, because in my medical armband is a little bridle tag that has Comet's name on it. There's a laminated 4-leaf clover that someone gave me. And then there's a little ribbon from our wedding that has our names on it in the year and stuff. And I think one of the medical officers, because they always have to turn in the card at the big events, you know, the check and make sure all your info's on there. And they're like, geez, dump it out. The medical armband and they get going. But that's important to me. And you can't fit that all on a little bracelet. So
Nope.
I'll be wearing that for a while.
Excellent answer.
Yeah. All right. So if eventing was not an option, what other riding discipline would you do?
Gosh, I want to try them all. I was in a community college program, and I rode 3 gated horses and 5 gated horses. I drove 5 harness. I showed Morgans. And I was just like, what would I do? I might take a run at the dressage and maybe the jumpers, I think.
How about that?
You know, right, I don't have a solid answer for you there, because I just really love a nice horse of any breed.
Mm-hmm. Well, you always cleaned up in the dressage. Dressage seemed to be like you were always at the top of the leaderboard in dressage.
That was just because of Comet. That was just always because, you know, he's just a ham. And so he just drug me along on his coat. That's how that works.
All right. Next question. Favorite event to compete at?
Kentucky. Always be Kentucky.
Good answer. All right. So last question. If you could ride any horse, past, present, or fiction, who would it be? Thinking hard on this.
It would have to be Ginny Lang's Priceless.
Hmm.
I don't know that one.
I don't know that horse either. What? Tell us all about it.
Oh, you got to look that one up. So Jenny Lang, priceless. He was one of her speed merchant horses. Believe he won badminton in the 1985. You're testing me now. So we'd have to go back and look at it. But one of the classic, if you see videos of some of the courses, you know, as in quotations back in the day where they're dropping off massive drops and down steep hills through triple bounces and crazy things where they had to combine that flat out speed with the amazing footwork and real classic uphill thoroughbreddy type. I actually don't know his exact breeding, but yeah, priceless. I picked priceless. Excellent. I really like have it. Have a sit on that one.
Very cool. We have to look that one up.
That one up. Probably on one of our VHSs downstairs.
It might be.
Karen, is there anything else?
A++.
A++. Excellent. Yes. Job. Excellent. Knocked it out of the park.
Yes,
Karen.
Yes.
Excellent.
Yes.
Excellent answers.
Love the socks one. Always love the socks. So, Becky, do you have any advice for a young rider trying to make it in a sport?
Don't give up. Do it and do it because you love it. I see too many people who try to approach eventing as a 5-year business plan type mentality, and it's not what it's about. You kind of have to give yourself up to the artistry and give yourself up to the pursuit of trying to learn about horses. And it's so fascinating because it always knocks you down and there's always something more to learn. And that's why there's, you know, so many of these crusty old folks and it's still taking lessons.
Yeah.
Cause we're constantly learning. So don't give up and do it for the right reasons.
Excellent.
Yeah. Excellent.
Excellent. Yep. Excellent answers. So, you know, we'll start winding things down. Mm-hmm. We don't want to keep, you know, Becky too long, Karen, but we always like to ask about, you know, supporters, anybody that you would like to kind of mention along the way. You know, so, the floor is open to shout out anybody that you'd like.
Well, through all the years, the people that have been behind me, my husband, my family, my parents, I'll never really know how much they gave up to give me opportunities. And in the early days, you know, like when I went to England and whatnot, I basically closed down an apartment and they were there and made things available to me right in the beginning. I had a syndicate in the early days for a horse named Rain Man, and they are still lifelong friends and students. It's a 10-person syndicate. And back in the days when that was still kind of new and hadn't been done a lot. And amazing people that they were with me from there. Phil and Melissa Town, who took a chance on buying Can't Fire Me from my longtime grooming assistant, Aubrey Dunkerton, and gave me a shot at another team run after Comet's retirement. They're amazing. All the farriers through all the years. Like, how many times do you call your farrier in tears? You know, almost as many times as you call your vet, and sometimes more. All the vets through the years, and especially the team guys, Steve Teachman, Brendan Furlong, that I saw work miracles and help make dreams come true at all of the team outings that we had. Gosh, my farriers, Roy Williams from Minnesota, Quentin Wiseman, Georgia, Mike Stein, North Carolina, and veterinarians, currently Dr. Tom Daniels of Southern Pines Equine, back in the day of team stuff, Dr. Christiana Ober, Ann Bauer, Minnesota, follow me around the country with all this, Dr. McClendon in Georgia, and way back in the day, Becky Bassett in Kansas. You know, I mean, you're only as good as the people that are around you, and I'm forever grateful to all of them who continue to support me and help me.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
What a list.
Oh, yeah.
Steve Teachman.
Yeah.
Great farrier.
Yeah.
That guy is
one of the best.
He is just retired.
Magician.
Yeah, he's a magician.
He's a magician. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some of the work, he'll like post pictures of some of the stuff he's done, and it is just incredible. He is a, He's a magician. He's a craftsman. He's all of the above, you know? Mm-hmm. So going to be sad to see his kind of talents, you know, if he's retired. Like, sometimes you feel like, come on, can't you come on out of retirement for the special case, you know? So he's a great guy. Know. So very, very cool. So in the end, you know, being that you're kind of elusive, how do people follow along? How do people, you know, catch up with you?
I would say that my Facebook page, maybe, my personal Facebook, probably, Becky Holder, and students tend to post and tag me. So you can kind of track me around the country that way. But I'm a bit of a social media stalker. I have to admit that a little bit, but I don't do much posting. I like to keep track of what people are doing, but they can, my contact info is on my Facebook page, and they can always track me down and get a hold of me if they have any questions about horses and training or coming and taking lessons. I love people to ship in, come for short training stints. We have great stables or great little areas for them to come and train on our farm with full cross country stuff. So if people are looking for a getaway for themselves and a couple of their friends, awesome. Happy to oblige people of all levels.
Awesome. Man, I love it.
Love it.
I love it. Becky's hard to find. She's elusive. What were you saying? Kyle Carter said he tries to track you down. What was that you said early on?
He can never get it right where I am, you know, what state I'm in. It's always very funny, you know. He's like, so where are you? Yeah. he's not the only one. For a lot of time, people didn't know if I was in Kansas or Minnesota or Georgia or North Carolina, but that's okay.
Well, you just named vets in like 39 of like the 50 states. <I know.
laughs> been a gypsy for a lot of my life.
Yeah, right.
Well, Becky, Karen, this was fantastic.
This was great.
Becky, this was such great. A treat, and it's such a pleasure because, you know, we are true fans, and we really have watched you for so many years. And it was just like, you know, when we started this podcast, it was like, we never thought we would really get like our heroes on,
yeah,
you know?
I know.
And here we are, you know, catching up with one of the greats. So, and we, and you know, you're not competing a whole lot these days, but it's great for people to really hear, you know, from you, you know what I mean? Like, I think it's, people can learn a lot from the way people came up in the sport and how they got to where mm-hmm. they are. And, just thank you for sharing your story with us. It was fantastic. And it was such a humble story.
Well, I really, it's frustrating to me to hear people talk about how, oh, you can't make it if you don't have the money and you don't have the supporters and you don't have the owners. And maybe I was an exception, but I know I had a lot of help. As, you know, I really wanted to learn and do it for the right reasons, but I just don't think it all boils down to money. There's so much more having to do with desire and hard work. I don't think anyone who met me in my early days thought, oh, she's going to the Olympics, she's really talented. Because I think, honestly, I was really very annoying. and probably not very talented, but I just kept showing up. I just kept showing up. Mm-hmm. And I there's a power in that. And I really shout out to anybody who wants it, go get it, you know, and don't let anything stop you.
I love it.
Yeah. Wise words.
Well, Becky, thank you so much again for joining us. This was fantastic.
Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed today's show. Please like Major League Venting on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And join our community, Major League Venters, on Facebook. Cheers!